Welcome to Trinity Forum Conversations. I'm Cherie Harder, the president of the Trinity Forum, and in our podcast today, we bring you a recording of an evening conversation with renowned sociologist and Trinity Forum founder, Oz Guinness, on his new book, A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future. This conversation was held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on September 18th of 2012 and sponsored by the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy and InterVarsity Press, and addresses the urgent question of how America should engage the challenges to ordered liberty posed by the internal erosion of civic character.
Good evening. I'd like to welcome you to this evening conversation with Oz Guinness. Thank you for coming out on such a rainy evening. My name is Bob Freiling. I serve as publisher of InterVarsity Press, which is a leading publisher of thoughtful Christian books. And we have had the privilege of publishing a number of books authored by Oz Guinness. In fact, we published his very first book, The Dust of Death, and his more recent book, A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom, and the American Future, which is the theme of our conversation this evening. I first heard Oz when he was lecturing with the LaBrie Fellowship. I remember at that time being very impressed with his ability to give analytical insight to culture and issues of faith. And this book continues in that tradition of what Oz has contributed to public thought and awareness of Christian faith and public policy. It is a profound book and is profoundly relevant. And there will be copies available, and Oz has graciously agreed to sign them if you'd like to get a signed copy after our time this evening. But again, thank you for coming. I'd like to turn things over to Pete Peterson.
Oh. Good evening. I'm Pete Peterson. I'm an executive director of the Davenport Institute for Public Engagement at Pepperdine, specifically at their School of Public Policy, and it is an honor to work with the Trinity Forum and co-sponsor with InterVarsity Press tonight's evening conversation. I bring you greetings from Malibu, or as I like to call it, the Lake Wobegon of the West, where all the women have paparazzi, all the men do their own stunts, and all the kids are epic. I'm glad some of you laughed, because this might be the last attempt at humor for the evening. Tonight we are about serious business, and we're going to be talking about things with a serious man. As Oz Guinness writes in his bracing new book, A Free People's Suicide, quote, "History is asking this question of America now. What kind of people do you Americans think you are?" To answer this question rightly demands contemplating a concept that is rather unpopular these days, that America and Americans are indeed different in ways that are vital to the future of free institutions in this country and around the world. Every now and then you see a story that reminds you of our uniqueness. Coming from Malibu, I thought it appropriate to bring a prop. This is Friday's Wall Street Journal business and finance section. Not sure if any of you saw the story on the front page of it, noting that the home improvement chain, the Home Depot, is set to close the last of its dozen stores it had opened in China over the last 2 years. The reason is more cultural than economical. And I want to quote from the article. Home Depot conceded that it misread the country's appetite for do-it-yourself products. The market trend says this is more of a do-it-for-me culture, a Home Depot spokesman said of China. America's do-it-yourself ethic, grounded in families and communities, has been an essential ingredient of our self-governance for centuries. But it is a culture that has always demanded the support of these institutions. These are issues that are central to the work we do at Pepperdine, which is why we're so excited to be a part of examining them tonight with Dr. Guinness. So thanks so much to all of you for making it out tonight. It's a real honor and pleasure to be here. And I will now turn it over to Cherie Harder to begin this evening's conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Pete, for that introduction. And good evening and welcome to all of you for tonight's evening conversation with Oz Guinness on the Free People's Suicide, Sustaining American Freedom. We're delighted that you're here. For all of us, this has been a very exciting and long-awaited event, and we anticipate a very fascinating and provocative conversation. And since there's rarely enough time to take all audience questions, one thing that we're going to offer tonight is that we'll be live blogging this event on both Facebook and our Twitter page. So if you have a question that's just burning inside of you and think you may not have a chance to answer it or to ask it, we invite you to participate in that way. For those of you who are not familiar with the Trinity Forum, we exist to provide a space and resources for leaders to engage life's greatest questions in the context of faith. And we do this by providing readings and publications which draw upon classic works of literature and sponsoring programs such as this to connect leading thinkers with thinking leaders in engaging the big questions and to come to better know the author of the answers. The great questions of the humanities relate to the purpose and the content of the good life and the good society, what it is, what it means, and how it's realized. And central to the American understanding of the good life and the just society is the ideal of freedom. But while many Americans may agree on the value and the necessity of freedom, notions of what freedom actually is or how it should be ordered are contested. And those disagreements form many of the major battle lines for both the political and cultural battles of our time. In his new book, A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future, published by InterVarsity Press, Oz Guinness argues that the greatest challenge of freedom lies not in winning it or in ordering it, but in keeping it. And the greatest threats come not from hostile regimes, but from within, from an internal erosion of the civic character necessary to preserve freedom. Or in his words, the main problem is not wolves at the door, but termites in the floor, which raises the vital question, what can be done to preserve freedom as we know it and the American experiment in ordered liberty? It's both a challenging and a controversial topic, and there are few who are more insightful in addressing it than our speaker tonight, Oz Guinness. Oz is an author, a sociologist, and I am very proud to say, the founder of the Trinity Forum. His scholarly work is certainly extensive, but he has also known firsthand over the course of his life what it means when freedom is lost. The great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, the Dublin brewer, Oz was born in China in World War II, where his parents were medical missionaries. He was a witness to the climax of the Chinese Revolution in 1949, and along with many other foreigners was expelled, and then later returned to Europe where he was educated in England, completing his undergraduate degree at the University of London and his DPhil in the social sciences from Oriel College at Oxford University. After working as a freelance reporter with the BBC, Oz came to the U.S. to work as a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies and later served as a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He then became the executive director of the Williamsburg Charter Foundation, a bicentennial celebration of the First Amendment, and went on to become the founder and the first senior fellow of the Trinity Forum. In his spare time, he has written or edited more than 25 books, including The American Hour, Time for Truth, The Call, Invitation to the Classics, Long Journey Home, and A Case for Civility, and most pertinent to our discussion today, A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom, and the American Future. Oz, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I deeply appreciate you all coming out on this rain-swept English evening. Jenny and I actually arrived in Washington on such an evening 28 years ago, just coming for 6 months, and we're still here. But it's a real pleasure. I'm often asked, as you can imagine, why do I, as an Englishman, take such an interest in the United States? And I could give many answers, whether people are serious or not, but one of my answers is a story of Winston Churchill. He was in Colonial Williamsburg being shown around, and the guide, almost forgetting that she was talking to the Prime Minister of Britain, was waxing eloquent about the cradle of the revolution against the English. And Churchill snorted. Revolution against the English, he said. They were Englishmen with English ideas fighting a German king with his German mercenaries. And, of course, Churchill was tongue-in-cheek, but, as usual, absolutely right. Many of your greatest American ideas are actually English ideas which have flowered here with more beauty and strength than sadly they did in England. That's why many of us who are English are great admirers of this country. Let me begin, though, with a story. Back in 1843, a young Massachusetts scholar was researching all the remaining veterans of the Revolutionary Wars. And he discovered an old man who was 70 years older than himself. He was 21. And Captain Levi Preston was 91. Very stooped and bowed over. And the young scholar said to him, "Now, why did you go out to fight?" And the old boy thought the question so obvious he didn't bother to answer. And slowly straightened himself up to his full height. "Well, surely you were facing intolerable oppressions." "We weren't oppressed," the old boy growled. "Well, what about the Stamp Act?" "Never paid a penny for it. He saw one of them," he said. "Well, how about the tea tax?" "Never drank a drop of it," he said. "The boys threw it all in the harbor before we got there." "Well, surely you'd read the great books on freedom with Sidney and Harrington and Locke and Burke." "Never heard of them," he said. "All we had was a Bible and a hymnal and an almanac." And the questions went on, and the researcher was getting more and more nonplussed, so he asked him again, "Well, why did you go out to fight?" And the old boy gave this immortal answer. "We had always been free, and we intended to be free always, and the redcoats didn't mean that we should." Now you just think of that. Free always, always free. The most brilliant and daring thing, intellectually and politically, that your founders did was to believe that they could create a free society that could remain free forever. Now, St. Augustine was very famous, put his paragraph in modern terms by saying, "To understand a nation, you look at what it loves supremely, or what he called its loved things held in common." And anyone, American, or looking at America from the outside, what is it that is the American thing loved and held in common? It would be freedom. And if Augustine was right, you can judge a nation by the nobility of what it loves supremely, and you can assess the health of a nation by seeing the condition of what it loves supremely at any one time. And so I think freedom is one of the key ways to understand this extraordinary culture. But I want to argue that the system the framers set up to see that freedom could last forever is today under general neglect and sometimes under explicit opposition. And so much of what's American freedom today is very, very different from the framers and is actually, in world historical sense, unsustainable, and is one of the reasons that will lead, if it continues, towards American decline. But let me walk through a number of steps with you, setting out propositions, beginning with how the framers understood what they were doing. First, they were very clear about the tasks they had in establishing a free society. As Cherie said, the first task was to win freedom, the revolution. 1776. But that part is not unique. The French did it. The Russians did it. The Chinese did it. I witnessed the Chinese climax. Many nations have done that. But the framers went on to win freedom and then order freedom, giving it a political, moral, institutional framework. And the French did not do it. The Russians and the Chinese did not do it. In fact, we could say their revolution spiraled down to demonic disorder and created tyrannies that were worse than the ones that they replaced. The genius of the American Revolution, freedom was won, freedom was ordered. Not the revolution, but the Constitution. But the third part, which is actually the key part today, is usually overlooked because the framers realized they had to win freedom, order freedom, and sustain freedom, or as they put it, perpetuate our institutions. Many people remember Ben Franklin coming out of the secret convention in Philadelphia, asked by Mrs. Powell what they'd achieved. A republic, madam, and you can end the sentence, if you can keep it. But few people can go on beyond that to understand how Adams and Madison and many, many others wrestle with this thing, how do we perpetuate freedom so that it lives over not just a few years or even a few decades, but the centuries. So you say in 1830s, the young Abraham Lincoln, 3 months in Springfield, Illinois, asked to address the Young Men's Lyceum. What would the topic be for his choice of the lecture? He chose the topic, the perpetuation of our institutions. How many 28-year-olds or 58-year-olds today would choose that topic? But he did. And he describes what he calls the accounts running 50 years after the revolution and shows the pros and the cons, the pluses, the minuses, the assets, and so on, of where America was doing 50 years on in terms of perpetuating the institutions. Now, of course, that is the challenge today. And yet with rare books like, say, John Gardner's Renewal, very, very few Americans discuss today the perpetuation of freedom and the institutions at the precise moment that it's most needed. Secondly, consider the menaces the framers knew that they were up against. They were, of course, revolutionary, but they were also rooted in the sense that they knew their history, they'd read their classics. In fact, we can say they used history to defy history. And in particular, they'd gone back to the great Roman orator Cicero and back to the Greek historian Polybius and understood why free societies never lasted. And if you look at the classical writers, there are three broad menaces that any free society faces. The first one, interestingly, the framers almost ignored. And that was the challenge of an external menace. If a nation suddenly finds itself with a nation stronger or better armed than itself, it's in trouble. And often all it can do, especially fall nations, is be vigilant. Now, the framers, interestingly, you can read George Washington's farewell address, did not take that one terribly seriously, for obvious reasons. Most of them, with the exception of John Jay, who came from France, had come from a small protected island, and they now lived on a large protected continent, and the nearest serious enemies were 3,000 miles away. And again, you can see in that same speech of Lincoln, he almost disdains the idea of a transatlantic Bonaparte, as he calls it. A transatlantic Bonaparte putting his feet down in the cornfields of Ohio. Unthinkable. Not today, of course. And after 9/11, with intercontinental ballistic missiles and the internet and box cutters, we know that external menaces are much more serious. But the second and third menaces they did take seriously, we don't. The second menace is what Polybius, the Greek historian, calls a corruption of customs. And Americans are challenged to think seriously because they read a sentence or two from him and then yawn. Polybius starts by saying what's decisive for any nation is its constitution, its fundamental laws. And Americans read that, and you have the world's oldest, strongest living constitution, and so what more do you need to say? But Polybius says a lot more. Polybius says the best constitution in the world, if you have a corruption of customs, an undermining of the traditions and the moral standards and the civic habits of the citizenry, you will subvert the best constitution. It'll still be there in name, but the reality will be quite different. And he warns that that happens most often in times of power and prosperity. The third menace in the classical writers is, in one word, time. You probably all know that the Constitution was passed the same year that the last volume of Edward Gibbon's classic, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, was published. And if you've ever read or had to read that classic, which is pretty long but fascinating, Gibbon raises the question in the last chapter, why did Rome fall? 800 years of dominance, a fall beyond belief, but she fell. Why? And his first answer, the injuries of time. And Gibbon says, I got the idea for writing the book because I was in Rome and I saw cattle grazing and grass growing where the senators deliberated. Time, passing time. And Cicero, who of course lives at that generation in which Rome went from a republic to an empire, and he was resisting, among others, Julius Caesar. Cicero says, things that are revolutionary become routine. Things that are fresh become faded, and slowly the republic is undermined. Now, of course, the framers realized, as Lincoln did later. You remember his much later speech in the hay wagon in Wisconsin. The story of the monarch sending his sages out across the world to find a truth that was true in all times and all places. And back they come with the famous line, this too shall pass. And Lincoln was tremendously aware of that challenge. He says, let us hope that in the case of America, it is not quite true, this too shall pass. If we cultivate our environment, he says, and equally we can cultivate the intellectual resources inside us, let us hope that it is not quite true of us. But the framers, and many afterwards, but hardly anyone today, were incredibly aware of those great challenges, external menaces, the corruption of customs, and the passing of time. Now let me break into that discussion by adding a modern point that is even clearer to us than it was to them in the light of great studies and scholarship on the notion of freedom itself. And that is, we need to understand the paradox that is at the heart of freedom. And the paradox is simply this. The greatest enemy of freedom is freedom. The greatest enemy of freedom is freedom. Now, if you unpack that conundrum, the obvious level is to look at history. Scholars say if you pack 100 centuries of civilization into 1 hour, free societies only come in the last 2 or 3 minutes. And they're rare, and they're fleeting. But deeper than that, you have a political level of the conundrum. As Montesquieu was very famous in underscoring, freedom will not last only through the structures of freedom, such as the Constitution and the law. The structures are necessary. Freedom has to be kept alive by the spirit of liberty in the hearts of the citizens. The structures you can lay down and they'll last a long time. But the spirit of liberty has to go every generation from parents to children and so on, or else eventually it will die. The deepest level of the conundrum and the paradox is moral. The only order that is appropriate to freedom, and freedom of course needs order, the only order that is appropriate to freedom is self-restraint, not of course external restraint. But self-restraint is precisely what freedom undermines when it flourishes. And among the many common ways that freedom undermines itself is that it turns itself into permissiveness and then license and becomes something very different from freedom. And as Lord Acton said famously, freedom is not the permission to do what you like. Freedom is the power to do what you ought. And notions of freedom for citizenry are very important. But how then did the framers seek to build in antidotes to what they clearly understood as the menaces to free societies lasting. Now, the framers never gave their system a name. Scholars like Bernard Bailyn say that it's as obvious as an 800-pound gorilla in the room, but they never named it, so many Americans are hardly aware of it today. Tocqueville famously calls it the habits of the heart. The laws are in place, but Tocqueville says American freedom is not protected by law alone, but more deeply by the habits of the heart. My own term for it, studying your founders, is the golden triangle of freedom. Because you can see in their voluminous teaching on this, right across the spectrum, you can go from evangelicals like John Jay and Patrick Henry, through very orthodox Christians like George Mason and George Washington, to deists like Thomas Jefferson, to free thinkers like Ben Franklin. But all of them agreed without exception on what I'm calling the golden triangle of freedom. And the three legs are these, very easy to say, but they of course unpack them in great depth. First, freedom requires virtue. Second, virtue requires faith of some sort. Thirdly, faith of any sort requires freedom. And like the recycling triangle that goes round and round ad infinitum, freedom requires virtue, which requires faith, which requires freedom, which requires virtue, and so on. Now, of course, John Adams in particular, and many of the others, George Washington's farewell address, for instance, unpack what they meant by virtue. The word, of course, in its classical sense, is rooted in the word for courage. So it wasn't our modern notions of goody-goodiness or anything like that. It included honesty, loyalty, patriotism, and of course, character in leadership and in the citizenry. And it's fascinating to see how, say, John Adams explores these things, and he uses words like inalienable, indefeasible, words that usually describe freedom, justice, rights. And he uses them to describe the people's right to know the character of their leaders. So they would argue openly that character is important because it stands, on the one hand, between followers and leaders. Citizens may have no idea why a leader makes the decision that he or she does. But if they know his or her character, they can trust in the dark. Equally, character is the bearing for leaders when there may be no laws and no other inhibitions to restrain them. But just as a matter of integrity and character, they will do what's right and not do what's wrong. Now you can see how under assault that is today. During the Clinton impeachment, there was a famous letter to the New York Times arguing, character did not matter in a president. What mattered was competence. And you can see how management and leadership today has a huge amount about competence, but remarkably little about the importance of character. And yet the fact is, you only need to take the history of the presidency to prove the framers' point. Take the Nixon administration. Richard Nixon actually had a word, CQ. Not only IQ, but CQ, character quotient. But as many historians have pointed out, it was the paranoia of the president. It was the vanity of the Secretary of State. It was the hubris of the Chief of Staff in the White House. There were character flaws which are behind so much of the Watergate crisis, which brought them down for all their great achievements in things like foreign affairs, character. But you can see how that's under assault today. The second leg of the triangle, of course, equally politically incorrect. Virtue requires faith of some sort. The framers did not say the Christian faith. There's no official, established, formal faith in this country, part of the uniqueness of this country. But they recognized that the inspiration of virtue, the content spelling out what virtue is, and of course the sanctions, what's said if someone is not virtuous, that was best rooted in a faith, put in modern sociological terms, that is thick rather than thin. and ephemeral. And the framers, in modern terms, are actually politically incorrect in that they openly championed freedom of conscience for atheists, of course, but they were openly wary of a society of atheists because they did not believe that it could create sufficient virtue in the citizenry to keep freedom going. And John Adams, again, I'm quoting him more than others, his ruminations on the future are a remarkable, prescient description of where we are in the postmodern era of philosophy. The third leg of the triangle, faith of any sort requires freedom, is, of course, the unique part of the American experiment. Not separation of powers. Americans tend to quote that. That's not unique. Montesquieu praises England for its separation of powers 100 years earlier. And, of course, the Swiss had their own separation of powers centuries earlier. Separation of powers, checks and balances. It may have been developed in a particular way in this country, but in no way is it unique. But the First Amendment, it reverses 1,500 years of European history, so now no faith is established. And of course, as we know, faith flourishes in this country, not despite disestablishment, but because of it, because faith is now made voluntary and a matter of the individual conscience of each person. But of course, for 50 years, following the culture wars, the early Madeleine Murray O'Hare cases and all the things since then, you can see that the understanding of that is heavily under assault. In fact, all three legs of the framers' triangle are under open assault or neglected today. What changed? Well, you can go right back to the 19th century to see that one factor with the rise of the industrial era was the steady privatization of faith. So the faiths that were here, Christian and otherwise, became privately engaging, publicly irrelevant. And a faith like that, of course, was not able to do what the framers assumed that any faith would do. And I would insist on starting there because many Christians make the mistake of blaming their enemies, whoever they see they are. Whereas, in fact, some of the problems started actually within the church way, way back in the 19th century. In the 20th century, you had the rise of what's now called proceduralism, often associated with John Rawls at Harvard. The idea that the public square is a neutral arena of competing self-interests, and faith and character and virtue are irrelevant. So faith and character and virtue are private matters and should be inviolably private, whereas the public square is inviolably secular. And you can see things like economics and law and rationality and technology, all these things are relevant in the public square, but not faith, not virtue, not character in the old sense. And you can see in most of the academic world that vision associated with John Rawls and others is largely the view of what public life should be among many of the American intelligentsia. More recently, a third factor is far more radical, postmodernism itself. And as you know, postmodernism says there is no such thing as truth. Any truth or claim to knowledge is really a bid for power. So we can be suspicious about all that, say, the framers did in the Declaration of Independence. It was really a power game. Virginia, title plantation owners, keeping their slaves oppressed, had these high-flown ideas of freedom and so on, but they never intended to follow through with them, and the postmoderns can equally dismiss them. Now, fortunately, that's the most recent and the most limited, although by far the most radical, but certainly contributes to the cynicism. And so today, because of the failures of the founders, slavery, attitudes to women, attitudes to Native Americans, you can see that the baby, the bathwater, and all is thrown out the window. And many people don't give a serious account to the founders where they were brilliant and daring, and I would argue gave the best answers history's put forward so far to how freedom can be sustained. But because of their blind spots, many Americans don't know them or openly oppose them. So here we are. What are some of the contemporary menaces to freedom? different levels, but I would say one is the serious alienation of many American leaders. I've been in many campuses across this country, maybe 50 over the last 30 years. Remarkable how few professors and others understand or support the vision of the framers. And many, of course, are openly opposed. Can any great nation survive if a sufficient number of its intelligentsia are at odds with what made it great? At a certain point, that certainly comes into question. But the second contemporary menace runs far deeper. And that is, in the last 50 years, we have seen a breakdown in the transmission of American values. America, as the great experiment, as Washington called it, is in the business of transmitting values in two ways in every generation. The obvious way is from the older generation to the younger generation, public education. The other way is from the old-timers in this country, because there are remarkably few natives, to the newcomers, immigration. But in the old days, both of those areas, education and immigration, had a strong element of civic education. And since the 1960s, that's virtually disappeared in both those areas, a real vacuum of civic education in most of the schools, and a vacuum of civic education in the discussion of immigration. I don't know about you, but in all the discussion I've heard in this town, English as a second language, border control, all sorts of economic issues, I've heard endless discussions of immigration. I have never heard one leader discuss the place of civic education for people who come to this country. And that was why people like Sam Huntington used to say, if we go on like this, eventually, immigration will put more of a stamp on America than the revolution. Or as another scholar says, it's relatively easy today to become an American, get your naturalization papers. But in many circles, increasingly difficult to know what it is to be American. Or as I put it, you take your motto, E Pluribus Unum. A magnificent motto, and even more, a towering achievement that many people would say is America's greatest achievement. Out of many, one. But of course, that requires that every generation knows what the unum is, the uniting first principles that form the balance to the pluribus, the diversity. I've been in many circles, and universities, business circles and in churches, I've asked people, just write down on a pad what you think are the first six elements of the American unum, the first principles that are common to all Americans, whatever the diversity of their backgrounds. And hardly anyone can get beyond two or three, unless they've been to a place like Hillsdale or John Jay or whatever. Otherwise, sadly few. There's a breakdown in the transmission of American values. But the third contemporary menace, I think, is the worst. Using Polybius' terms, we have seen a corruption of customs. And I would argue, especially with freedom. Abraham Lincoln, as you know, called the Civil War a freedom war. In that both sides, the North and the South, cited freedom, but they actually gave very different definitions to it. And in the same way, if you analyze many of the issues in today's culture warring, what's at stake are actually very profoundly different views of freedom. Broadly, you have Jewish and Christian notions of freedom, which have shaped the West for most of 2,000 years, pitted against secular and liberal and very different views of freedom. And you can see that for various reasons, most American freedoms today are libertarian or varieties of that. Put it in the framers' terms for philosophers, we have more negative freedom than we have positive freedom. Negative freedom is freedom from. And of course, that's essential freedom from colonial oppression, freedom from addiction, freedom from chains. We all need freedom from, if we're under any oppression. Freedom from, negative freedom, is essential, but only preliminary. As all the great champions of freedom pointed out, negative freedom should lead to positive freedom, freedom for, freedom to be, which of course assumes an understanding of truth so that we know what it is we're supposed to be as humans or as citizens or whatever. But almost all American freedom today is a negative freedom, freedom from. Getting the government off our backs, getting the government say away from my body, or whatever it is. Both conservatives and liberals largely have a negative view of freedom that is quite literally unsustainable. What needs to be put right? Some of the things that need tackling are actually relatively simple and easy to say, but hard to do. The first I've hinted at already, which is the restoration of civic education. It's always been understood in free societies that in a free society, everybody is born free. Not everybody is capable automatically of freedom. They have to be educated for liberty, liberal education, civic education. But as I said, that has largely disappeared. And you not only have backward-looking unions who are often a problem in this area, you have very progressive foundations putting a lot of money into American education and concerned only for things like science and math and keeping up with the Chinese, rather than also bringing back civic education for American citizens. A second area that needs to be tackled is the reopening of a civil public square. Madison described your settlement of all the different faiths in public life as the true remedy for the world. And yet 50 years of culture warring have slowly closed much of the public square, and now we have endless litigations from one extreme or another. And at the very moment when America should be a model to the world, because the whole world is wrestling with the question, how do we live with our deep differences? And America has the best answer that any country's had in history. But the very moment the American way is most relevant, America's not practicing her own way. And we need to transcend the extremism and much of the gridlock and really open up a civil public square in the interests of all Americans. Thirdly, I think, and this underlies many of the other things, we need leadership. It's often said, but you rarely have leadership today in the order of a Lincoln or a FDR that stands above so much of the partisanship and the wrangling and articulates a vision for all Americans. And if ever that was needed, it's today. One of the saddest things I felt as a foreign admirer of this country and a visitor, in the last 10 years, I've asked many, many groups, including relatively large groups of CEOs, who for you is the leader who could stand above all this and articulate way forward for all Americans? And so far, and a member of Congress said the same thing to me very recently, so far, nobody has said anybody. Now, where are we? The last time I was asked to speak on this was, Cherie, before the book came out. We had the privilege of being down in Colombia, where they had Thomas Cole's paintings, The Course of Empire. You all must have seen it, either the paintings themselves or on the front cover of this book or that book. In the 1830s, Thomas Cole painted these five huge murals that range from what he calls a savage scene, to a pastoral scene, to the consummation of civilization, to destruction, and the final painting, desolation. And the middle two, of course, you've seen this magnificent sort of Greek-Roman civilization with all the marble pillars, temples, and buildings, and so on. And Cole, back then, roughly the same time when Lincoln was warning of the same things, was showing what he called the course of empire. And we had a wonderful reception down there. And then the chairman for the evening got up and he said, "Now, we've all seen these paintings. My only question is, where are we now?" And my guess, he said, is we're somewhere between 3, the grand consummation, and 4, the destruction of empire. We are at an extraordinary moment. There's no question that we're at the end of 500 years of Western dominance. From the early Portuguese navigators in the Spanish Empire, right down through the French and the Dutch and the British and the American century, the West has dominated the world, but in the global era, that is over. And so where America stands today is of extraordinary significance, not only obviously for you Americans, but for the world itself. I would just raise the question, though, is the hope of restoration? And the framers would also say yes. I'm intrigued by the fact of the framers' understanding of the parallels between them and the Puritans and the Jews before them, because they understood themselves as a kind of nationalized, secularized equivalent of what the Puritans and the Jews did before them. And there were 3 parallels in their understanding, and the first 2 don't help us, but the 3rd one is fascinating. What the Jews called Exodus, Puritans called conversion, and the framers called nationalized, secularized revolution. In other words, liberating experiences that formed a new people. The 2nd parallel is interesting too. What the Jews called covenant, the Puritans also called covenant, and the framers, of course, called constitution. But the 3rd parallel is the really interesting one for what we're talking about. What the Jews called return, and that word is so simple that many people reading the Jewish Torah miss it. Because in the Jewish scriptures, you see that when people turn away from God to false gods, they can turn back from those false gods to God, and God returns to them. And the Jews call it return. And the Puritans, in their turn, called it revival. But the framers had their national, secular, political equivalent, which many Americans don't explore. One who was very conservative, George Mason, he said we need a frequent recurrence to fundamental first principles. Every generation needs to keep going back. Thomas Jefferson, Mr. Jay, who was far more liberal, of course, Mr. Jay said we need a revolution every 20 years. Because as Tocqueville said, every generation is a new people. And every generation needs to buy into it all over again, or a generation will arise that forgets where they've come from. But it is possible to go back. Now we're told you can't turn the clock back. Scientifically, that's true. Technologically, that's true. But historically, culturally, morally, that's not true. 2 of our greatest movements of ideas in the Western world were both a matter of turning the clock back. The Renaissance and the Reformation. The Renaissance going back to the roots of classical learning. The Reformation going back to the teachings of Jesus. Both of them went forward powerfully by going back first. And in many ways, that's the same vision of the framers, that America can best go forward by going back first to the best of the first principles of the past. I often end, I was so stunned when I first read it, in Alexis de Tocqueville. As you know, he wrote Democracy in America, and Americans naturally love it because it praises American democracy. But he didn't write it for Americans. He wrote it for Frenchmen, in French. And as you know, he was a great admirer of the American Revolution. And he was a disappointed lover of the French Revolution. But he was always comparing revolutions, and especially those 2. And towards the end of his life, he had a little throwaway line. He said, "In a revolution, as in a novel, the hard part to invent is the ending." That is this generation's challenge. With their blind spots, your framers were a remarkable group of people. No nation has ever had so many in one generation that were so brilliant, so daring, and so capable with their blind spots. There have been many great chapters since. Just think of the greatest generation. But there's no question that anyone looking at the state of the American Republic today, this generation will have to step forward and see a restoration of what it means to be a free republic sustaining its freedom, or face inevitable decline. The choice will be this generation's. But sadly, so often, as you can see in the economy and other areas, we're saddling future generations with consequences that we should be bearing today. Thank you. We have some time for anyone to raise any questions, so if you don't mind, just stand up and sing out so everyone can hear what you're saying. Oh, no, there is a mic coming. Thank you, Lucy. You don't need to stand then if you don't want to.
Thank you very much for your talk, Mr. Guinness. As you were speaking, I thought of a book I'd read by, I believe it was John Henry Newhouse. He wrote American Babylon, and he raises the question of civic religion. And I wonder, as Christians, how do we engage in a society that is largely secular and inhabited by secular people without conflating it with Christianity?
Mm-hmm. You've got three options on the table. And I think the American one is distinctive. You've got European state churches, and they were a disaster because they are the single source of the evils that Christendom has perpetrated on the world. If you think of things like the Inquisition, the slaughter of the Albigensians, the excesses of the Crusades, all of those grew from the heart of Christendom. And it was a great Catholic scholar who critiqued all that, who gave the famous saying, all power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So state churches are oppressive. And you can see today, say something like, in a Muslim context, Iran, highly oppressive. So that's not the American way. Then you've got civil religion. And that's often misunderstood. That idea came from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who says that nations who reject a state church still need something to hold them together if you don't have an official state church as the official canopy. So what happens is that whatever is the uniting force in a nation will come to be treasured, revered, respected, and eventually worshipped. But, put simply, civil religion is a nation worshipping itself. Whatever binds it together, we eventually worship. And so I think the three great Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, the Christian faith, and Islam, there is no God but God. So all the Abrahamic faiths are opposed to civil religion and to nationalism, the worship of a nation. Patriotism, yes. Nationalism, no. Now, I understand the American experiment to be different from both of those. Not established, that's obvious, but not civil religion either. That's less obvious, but equally dangerous. The American position is a gamble. Washington calls it an experiment, and experiments are open-ended. So the way we put it in the Williamsburg Charter, I can't quite quote it exactly, the Republic assumes and requires ultimate beliefs, because otherwise there's no foundations for what it believes, but it rejects any official formulation of what those beliefs have to be. That's why it's a gamble. Or let me put it differently. Constitutionally, First Amendment, etc., anyone in this country can believe anything they want based on the dictates of their conscience. But culturally, as opposed to constitutionally, some beliefs would bring the whole experiment down. And so the Republic is a gamble. Jefferson's quite clear. You've got to let truth enter the debate. Truth is great and shall prevail, he quotes the old Irish maxim. In other words, the Republic is a gamble. There's an openness there. And if citizens who don't believe things that are important to freedom and humanity, etc., 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 don't enter the public debate and argue for the things that matter, then the Republic could well be in trouble. And you can see there are always two ways it could collapse. One is you have such openness, because of the freedom, that beliefs arise that are dangerous to the Republic. And we all know, you just take two examples, a Christian and a Muslim example. You have the Christian Reconstructionists. Now, they're tiny, so they're not a danger. But if they were to win, they would be a danger. And Gary North, among others, he says, we will play the pluralistic game to put everyone else out of the game. You know, like one man, one vote, one time sort of thing. The other danger is you have some of the Muslim radicals who want to replace the Constitution with a caliphate. Now, either way, the challenge is for Americans who know the American system to so argue for all that's necessary for freedom to survive and freedom of conscience for people of all faiths, etc., that such views never prevail. The other way the whole system could go down is that you have such incredible diversity, it becomes indifference. Who cares what anyone believes? And eventually, it just slumps into apathy. No, this republic depends on living beliefs that matter to people. And if ever the day comes when that disappears, America's in trouble. It is an open experiment. Yeah. George.
Oz, given what you said about the robust expression of religion in public life and sort of religious faith in the public square, forthrightness, might you comment on the Republican presidential nominee and vice presidential nominee in terms of sort of animating norms or limiting principles that may be guiding those two men in how they are transparent about religious faith on the presidential ticket? You know, what are the...
Josh, we're in the election season. I'm an Englishman. I'm bipartisan. I'm not getting into any of your partisan... God bless you, go to it. Do you want to ask me privately? Whoever gets the mic. Yes.
So, first, thank you for adopting, with your robust intellect, America's past, present, and future. Your comments are prescient and sobering. And others may ask something that is far more grand. Mine is much more personal. I think you're fairly prophetic, and if we follow the gentleman who hosted the event in Charleston to suggest that we're somewhere between the third and the fifth painting, how does one live day in and day out with what could be a bit of a depressing job?
Gosh. We all have our circles of influence, and that's, for me, a very precious notion at the heart of the Christian notion of calling. None of us is responsible for the whole world. We're all finite. We all only have 24 hours a day. We've only got so many dollars in our pockets and gray cells in our skulls. And so our influence is limited, but we all have circles of influence. And if we so live and so speak within those circles of influence, that's really what we're responsible for. And the trouble in much of America today is that actually the good citizens of America, you meet all across the country, salt of the earth people, you know, they are overshadowed, shouted down on the blogs or on the television or whatever. But we've just got to trust that if each of us works and lives and speaks within the circles of influence we have, that's what we're to do. And of course, for Christians, that would certainly include prayer as one of the most powerful things we do, as well as action in various places. But I would think through that. Sorry, I can't.
Thank you, Dr. Guinness. The call to leadership, it strikes me that as we look inward at our founding fathers, we look at these historic and consequential times in our country, are we at risk of missing something very significant external in these flashpoints around the world? So I guess my question would be current events. We have a presidential election that's swirling. Even tonight, we're focused inward on our roots, and our founders. But yet it strikes me that if the world is flat, Friedman, and the Internet has, and social media has really opened our society up to the rest of the world, that might we be at risk of missing something really significant in these events in the Middle East, in Asia, and these uprisings that are flashing right now?
Mm-hmm. Tonight's topic, you know, is American freedom. Give me a little longer, Dane, and we could do a whole series on globalization. I mean, I think globalization is the central fact of our time. And I just hinted we're at the end of 500 years of Western dominance. The reason for that is globalization, because one of the effects of globalization, we've shifted from what's called a singular modernity. In other words, one nation is the lead society advancing modernity. We've shifted from that, and it was the Spanish, the French, the British, etc. And now we're in a world of what's called multiple modernities. So you've got an Asian modernity, you've got a European modernity, and you've got an American modernity. And each country, as well as each continent, is free to adapt to the global world with their own history and their own values. So you've got in Asia, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, etc., etc. And Americans have got to adapt to this. And the nonsense said about we're going to have another American century, this is just hubris. The day of easy American dominance is over. Not because anything to do with American decline necessarily, but simply this is another world. And just as Britain had to adapt to that, so America would. So you're absolutely right. Now we've got to put our best minds to understanding what's happening. So in the Middle East, you've got, you know, all sorts of factors at work. And I just wish that leaders, and I'm not addressing the other side, I mean, one of the comments on one of the conventions was that it was more Pat Boone than Winston Churchill. And when I read that, I couldn't help thinking, that's exactly right. I mean, I was born under Churchill, grew up under Churchill, listened to all his speeches that are recorded. He always addressed the moment with an incredible sense of history and then the stakes for democracy or whatever it was. And you listen to the speeches today, I'm not picking out side, Josh, I'm going to be bipartisan, you know, they're just not addressing the world I know as I open my eyes and look out there. And this is tragic. We need leadership that is really addressing the state of the world and the state of America. And forgive me, you have required annually a State of the Union address. But when did you last hear a president really describe the State of the Union? No. They're political rallies, applause-cued lines with senators and congressmen bobbing up and down like puppets. You know, when are we going to have serious leadership on the level of some of the greats we've had? Hopefully we will, but we don't now.
Years ago, you talked about Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov and the idea of freedom and security. And it seems that our society is leaning more towards security. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Historians of freedom say it always breaks down, almost always, in three ways. I mentioned the first. Freedom, losing self-restraint, becomes permissiveness and license and undermines itself. The second way is what you're suggesting, Tim, and that is that free people love to be safe. And so they put an emphasis on security, and so much security that they're no longer free. And clearly, I mean, England used to be one of the champions of freedom. Boy, talk about one nation under surveillance. There's not an inch of any road in Britain that's not under CCTV. And it's not funny. Everything covered. And the regulations, I mean, we are strangling with surveillance today, say in Britain, and you've gone a long way since 9/11 towards the same sort of thing. That's the second way. The third way is that free people
love freedom so much they justify everything they do in the name of freedom, naturally, even things that contradict freedom. Take Abu Ghraib, or Bagram, or whatever, or the justification. Europeans, let me say it bluntly, Europeans were horrified. I mean, conservative Europeans were horrified to hear an American vice president arguing for torture. We never thought we'd hear that from American leaders. Anyway, those are the three ways, and you're referring, Tim, to the second one. Freedom can be undermined by too much love of security. Lucy, this side here has been very patient. This gentleman.
You had talked about UNUM and the principles associated with that. We won't ask you for six, but if you gave four, what would they look like?
You're Americans. Why don't I put it back to you? Sing out with some of them. Obviously, the first one is the rule of law. What else would you put on the table? Yep. Freedom of conscience, separation of church and state. What are we up to, six or seven? Better than many business groups I've asked, anyway. No, I think you could put about 10, but I'm not thinking of them tonight. But every American should know those. And if you look at something like all the suspicion of the melting pot today, you know, all the immigration studies show that, say, from Europe to America, a number of things happened. First, people who were thinking always of the past and tradition were Americanized and thought of the future. People who thought of blood and kinship became American and think of beliefs and the American ideal and project. In other words, they went to the public schools, they were taught these things, and they really became part of what it is to be American. And they could articulate it, but not today. And that's sad.
Thank you, Dr. Guinness. You said that conservatives have a view of freedom that is unsustainable. Could you expand on that?
Sorry, who does?
That you said that conservatives and liberals have a view of freedom that is unsustainable. Could you expand on what you mean by conservatives have a...
Many people have a kind of Ayn Randian libertarian view of freedom that is just freedom from all regulations, outside controls, or whatever. And obviously liberals want to get government away from anything to do with their bodies, and conservatives government out of all sorts of things, but they're all negative freedom. And you hardly, I know many conservative friends around town who are open libertarians and don't have any understanding of the positive descriptions of freedom and citizenship. And that's the sort of thing I mean. So it's not just conservatives saying, oh, liberals are like that. No, no, no. Many conservatives are like that much more than they realize, too. Both are today. And you don't have that positive. What is required of a citizen? I mean, just take the notion that I love and speak on and write on, civility. Civility to most Americans now is a wimp word. You know, squeamishness about difference. We've got to be nice to people. Something to do with dinner party etiquette? No. Civility is a classical idea. It is a Republican virtue. It is a democratic necessity. If you're in a highly pluralistic society, you need to know how to deal with fellow citizens who have very different backgrounds from you. And that is what's called civility. And it's part of the oil that greases the machinery of a very diverse society. And without it, as you can see, everything becomes highly litigious, etc. So you can see how few conservatives, as well as liberals, prize civility today. Just one of many things you can say.
Well, I guess I just would like to contribute an idea. As a mental health professional, and I particularly liked your point about being able to be free to do the right thing, you know, and in particular, the way I see that as a psychologist is due to fear. And, you know, the most oft-cited emotion in the Bible is fear. I believe it's like three times more than the next,
right.
Like 600 times. Fear not. And, you know, the anxiety to, you know, when we're born, we are high on anxiety and low on freedom, and the personal, spiritual, moral journey would be to diminish anxiety and increase freedom so that you are free to do the right thing. And I think when we talk communally and nationally, when we are preyed upon in terms of fear, you know, fear that somebody's going to attack you or fear that somebody's taking something from you or there won't be enough, I see it as a cause of a lot of our bad behavior. Mm-hmm. So I think freedom and anxiety are inextricably woven.
Oh, that's an incredibly important point. Not only is that's the most common refrain in the Hebrew and the Christian scriptures, have no fear. It's the most common thing Jesus says. It's right in the Old Testament, the New Testament, have no fear. It's also interesting, fear is the dominant world emotion. And obviously in the global era, the world is bigger than ever. People talk about the global village. Actually, the world is bigger for most people. And we see it all as it happens. And it's changing faster than any of us control. As someone said, the whole world's interconnected, no one's in charge. And not surprisingly, people are afraid. And I think our first response from it, that's negative, freedom from fear. And Roosevelt rightly put it that way. And I think that's incredibly important. And, you know, speaking as a follower of Jesus, to me it's a very important thing to have no fear. God is greater than all. God can be trusted in all situations. So have no fear. Just go out and do my small part, and all of us can do the same. So you figure out for yourself your responses. I'll just finish with this. Jenny and I and Kelly and a number of others were invited into a congressman. I came back from Europe this summer. And he said, I like your book, but I have one problem with it. It's too optimistic. I don't think America has 5 years, he said. And I certainly know a lot of people who believe that we're at a very, very serious moment. But I'm a little more hopeful than that. I think things are more open than that. But it will take leadership and it will take citizens acting, because we're at a key part in the novel, keeping freedom going. Thank you, Sheree.
Thank you, Oz. Certainly a lot to think about. We will be opening up the bar afterwards for those of you who might be tempted to drink heavily after hearing Oz's remarks. But we hope that you'll stick around and join us for a drink and for further discussion. Each of you should have on your chair an invitation to join the Trinity Forum Society. We hope that you'll avail yourself of that invitation, which opens up opportunities for more events like this to engage in these kinds of lectures and conversations and discussions on the big issues of life, as well as to receive Trinity Forum readings, such as Vaclav Havel's Politics, Morality, and Civility, which attempts to basically bring the best of the arts and letters, both in classic and contemporary literature, make them accessible, and help us participate in the ongoing and great conversation. As an added incentive for anyone who might be interested in joining the Trinity Forum Society, we will give you a free copy just tonight of Oz Guinness's book, Free People Suicide. Oz will also be sticking around. We'll have his books for sale in the next room. I think he can probably be prevailed upon to sign a few of those, and hope that you'll stick around for that. In addition, the next event that we'll be having on October 4th is a D.C. reading group. We'll be discussing Winston Churchill's painting as a pastime. Churchill certainly been mentioned quite a bit tonight, and it's interesting that he wrote this essay when all the world seemed the most bleak, was exactly when he decided to make art. And it's an interesting perspective that many of you will, I think, quite enjoy, and we hope that you'll join us for that. Also, our next evening conversation is 1 month from tonight at the University Club. A poet and former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, Dana Gioia, will be joining us to talk about his newest collection of poetry, Pity the Beautiful, which deals with poetry prayer and pathos, and we hope that you'll enjoy us for that as well. Finally, I'd just like to send some acknowledgments and thanks. We're delighted to have two of our trustees here tonight, Kathy Wills-Wright and Byron Smith, joining us from Nashville. Delighted that all of you could come. Also, just want to thank our partners, Bob Freiling from InterVarsity Press and Pete Peterson from the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. Thank you all for coming, and good night. You've been listening to a podcast of the Trinity Forum Evening Conversation held on September 18, 2012, with Trinity Forum founder Oz Guinness on his new book, A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future. For more exclusive interviews with and talks by other thought leaders, please visit our website at www.tts.org. Thank you for joining us.